a friend in Jesus. Yesterday, he hurled a bridge from eternity, a bridge of light and life. He who is the light and gave us life hurled a bridge into the darkness we had created, and it cannot be put out. And today you have the temerity to sing, "He is our friend." Beautiful. What a friend we have in Jesus. Only one question to you. What kind of friend? What kind of friend do you have in Jesus? Where did Jesus come from? Did he come from the south where you say, "Hey"? You know, and that's the way you're friendly. And if you're not friendly, they know you're not a Christian. Isn't that right? Or what about the Southwest campuses? "Hi, y'all." Is that the kind of friend Jesus is? Or there are some few of you who trickle down from the Northeast where you're kind of taciturn and suspicious, but once somebody wins your heart, you are theirs for life, so they tell us. Is that it? Jesus kind of standing off like a New Englander, waiting to be invited and then becoming really faithful and chummy? Is that the kind of friend you're talking about? What kind of friend do you have in Jesus? Or you're from the West Coast, where when you're friendly, people have to be suspicious. Yeah. Incidentally, David, wherever David went, we should be able to hear him. Yes. This is an Edwardian cut. Before you and Travolta ever came along, it was in existence, believe me. And I don't just mean the cut, I mean this specific suit. Now, what kind of friend do you have in Jesus? Let me tell you about friendship. Let me embellish a story a little bit. You need help on Monday. I can see that. I mean, you're in no condition to turn to the Word in the shape you're in, so I want to get you there. In Fort Worth, I had a sustaining medical community. I mean, I had a doctor who wouldn't quit. He was a real friend. I would call and go down, and his nurses would be prepared. "Oh, hello, Dr. Hendricks. Have you seen the latest copy of Antique Journal?" I don't know why they always associated me with an antique. Nevertheless, I would make myself comfortable. If I, after 5 minutes, one looks at one's watch, it's called winning through intimidation. After 7 minutes, you know, I say, "Did you inform the nurse maybe that I was here?" "Oh, just a minute." "Well, do come in the first room." And then they began to do all those auxiliary things, untie your shoelaces, take your blood pressure. You know, they didn't do my weight. They said, "We'll do your height instead." Finally, I get in to see my doctor. He's a lovely person. And he says, "Now, we've taken all of these tests and you have a borderline blood sugar problem. You're going to have to watch it, please. Furthermore, you've got gout." "Doctor, I can't have gout." "Gout is the disease of dirty old men." "Oh, no, 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 no. Gout is the disease of sensitive people and royalty." "Okay, I've got gout." "I've got gout." And on it goes, and I get ill, you know, and he puts me in Fort Worth Children's Hospital. That didn't elude me either. Third floor where there are the privileged few and the nurses tiptoe in and out and et cetera and ad nauseum. And I mean, it was quality. He was my friend. I'm in San Francisco, needed some medical attention. I went to the office of a new physician that I'm now using. They don't use the nurses there to come get you. They just open the door. "Hey, you in the blue suit and the pot belly, come on in." He says, "Okay, I've run these tests, and I'm not going to mess around with you with language. You got the diabetes. Take these pills, shut up, lose 10 pounds of that flab, and come back in 2 weeks." Do you know to whom you're speaking? Yeah, I got it right here on the chart. Hendricks, William L. Kooky name, isn't it? Which one was my friend? Both of them. Both of them. Young people, today I'm going to lay a heavy trip on you. A really heavy trip. You have been making Jesus emotionally in your own image. Quit it. If Jesus is my friend, then, you know, I can kind of put one over on him, or he understands, or I can do this, or look, let's let the word this morning tell you what kind of friend he is, and you quit making him over emotionally in your own image. That's serious business. Now to the word. Chapter 2, 3, and 4. Under the title this morning of Cana of Galilee, round trip. It starts in Cana of Galilee, chapter 2, verses 1 through 11, a bridge toward faith. A bridge toward faith. On the third day, there was a marriage in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus also was invited to the marriage with his disciples. Third day. If you've been keeping track, for you see, this ought to be a part, the first 12 verses ought to be a part of chapter number 1. You know how the Bible got divided into chapters and verses. It was in the 16th century. A French priest was riding across a mule on the southern France, and every time the mule jogged, he put a period. Well, it isn't quite that bad, but of course the Bible didn't come originally in chapter and verses, and verses 1 through 12 belong to be in the first chapter. And if you, in fact, chapter 1 should be verses 1 through 18 and then, you know, chapter 2. But that would mess your mind up, so we won't do that. Besides that, it would ruin the printing industry. Nevertheless, if you're keeping track, third day, this is a week in the ministry of Jesus. Go back now today sometime and count through the days in chapter 1. This is a week. Is it a second week of creation? Is it the continuing of Genesis? Is this the week of the Son, even as the week of the Father had had its creative impact in the first insight? Could be. Nevertheless, this rounds out a week. And what a week it was. And what an occasion it was. The mother of Jesus was there. He had grown up and left home. And you didn't, in those days, leave home with a widowed mother and younger brothers and sisters until you got married. But he did. What human pathos and trauma is there, remember, when you, quote, left home? Tisn't easy. Tisn't easy. So he went back, and Jesus' mother was at Cana, a little village up in Nazareth. And Jesus went to the wedding feast with his friends, these newfound disciples that he had gathered in chapter 1. And it wasn't a very proper thing to do. He did not announce that he was coming. And he had a troop by this time that may have been at least 5, might have been 6, could have been as many as 10 people. You see, when you had a wedding feast in those days, it lasted a real live week. And they were supposed to have enough food, refreshments, and gemütlichkeit to go around for a whole week. There wasn't. They were running low on the you-know-what. And it is you-know-what. And so Jesus' mother says to him with just an edge of reproach, because frankly, it's a little cool between them. A little cool between Jesus and the Virgin Mary? Yes. Yes, you see, that's what I mean. You've been making Jesus in your own image. You did not let him come out of the gospel to you. And the wine failed, and the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And the implication is, child, you brought 10 uninvited guests. you know? Do you ever come home after church with a cast of thousands and your mother said, next time if you don't let me know, I'm going to pinch your head off. Somehow, you don't get much out of the Bible because you don't let it be God's word of reality to the reality of your life, and that's the only way it's going to come to life. And Jesus said, Jesus said, that's not my affair. Yes. That's not my affair. My soul, what kind of brattish attitude are we dealing with here? That's what he said. It's not my affair. Woman, it's not my affair. Now, whatever commentaries you've been reading, they cannot gloss over the fact that this is a kind of abrasive response. I'm doing Rudolf Schnakenberg this summer. I would have brought the books up. It's come in 2 volumes, except I can't carry them. Cost $30 a piece, the last word, quote unquote. Doesn't matter whatever you've been reading, they still all boil down to the fact that however you want to pussyfoot around this kind of situation, there is a kind of distancing here. It occurs all through John's gospel because you see, this one moves on a different plane from everybody else, even his own family. And that's the problem with you if you make him emotionally in your image and he belongs to your church and he's your kind of folks, then he isn't different enough from you. Sorry about that, but I'm not. You'd better let the Son stand over against everybody as well as with you. Let him also stand in contradiction to you. Because if he's always your buddy, he says, hi y'all, you know Jesus before he was a superstar, and you and he can work things out together, and you leave the implication with those people you're trying to witness to that you and Jesus are always buddies and pals, and you're in this corner, and you want to get him in your corner so you can what? Make him act like you do or make her act like you do? Is that what you mean by conversion experience? You better read the gospel. Do not recreate Jesus in your own emotional image. The Gospel of John will stand in judgment against you. And he said, woman, that's not my business. That's not my problem. Because my hour hasn't come yet. All the way through John with magnificent monotony, he keeps saying, my hour hasn't come yet, my hour hasn't come yet. And all the way this week, his hour will not yet have come. Because we only go through chapter 11. That's right. That's what they said. You do John 1 through 11. I said, that's half the story. I said, that's all the time you get. The hour doesn't come until, listen to this, the hour doesn't come until one of his friends goes out to betray him. My hour is at hand. But that's beyond this week. But it's a part of this week. And I wouldn't want you to miss it. He said, woman, that's not my problem. And she said, really, she was a remarkable woman. Do not let the piety of some of the older Christian communities concerning her turn you off to the reality of what a great mother she was. She said to the people who were helping, do what he tells you to do. Now, how's that for the contradiction? Do what he tells you to do, and they had 6 stone wine jars that were, you see, pure, used for the water of purification. If they had just been clay, they could not have been used in purifying rites, but they were stone wine jars. They held so many firkins apiece, and we finally have figured that out. That's about 9 gallons each. That's 9 times 6 is 54, or it used to be. And probably 54 got my soul in sad exile. That's a bit much. Is it possibly a misunderstanding of this? I'm going to have to tell you this in camera. That's Latin for in secret. There were a group of Baptists in Kentucky called the 40-gallon Baptists who used to have the Lord's Supper at the associational meeting. And guess what they said you had to have in order to have a genuine biblical Lord's Supper? 40 gallons. That's right. And they did. It probably was on the misunderstanding of this passage because they really should have had 54. Now, be that as it may, they turned and skimmed off some of the water, brought it to the charge d'affaires, the maitre d', and he said, "Hey, this is great stuff." To the bridegroom, he said, "You've been holding out on us, fella. The smart people would have put the best first, and then when they got a little bit into the cups and didn't know what was coming, they would have brought out the best. But this, you've saved the best to last." Now, what does all of that mean? Well, I think it means what it says, first off. There's no harm in believing the Bible for what it says. But you see, of course, we haven't wanted to believe that because we didn't like what it said in that particular part. So that's all right, too. And there's perfectly legitimate reason. I was doing Lord's Supper at the congregation where I'm the interim pastor. They said, "Why do we use grape juice?" I said, "Because it is our tradition to be against alcohol since it has been so refined in these modern days, and that's why we use it. And I think it's appropriate that we do because I'm a teetotaler." Aha, there you have it. But that doesn't mean you can run around changing the Bible and pretending that Greek words don't mean what they plainly say. I mean, you can't have it both ways, folks. So just let Jesus belong to his day, all right? Why not? Don't always run around trying to modernize him, and worse than that, archaize yourself. So, it means that, but it probably means something else too. It means that the purification water of Judaism is now being changed into the wine of the new wine that cannot be put into old wineskins. You see, John's the gospel that talks about history and sometimes embroiders so many beautiful insights over it that you will miss it if you do not look very deep beneath those shadows to find the fine chiaroscuro in the shades to see that there are figures lurking there you had not supposed. And so it is. But why did he do it in the first place? Well, I'll tell you why he didn't do it. I went to a sweetheart banquet once. I'm off those for life. My goodness. They're kind of, you know, yuck. Be that as it may, I went to a sweetheart banquet and opened the program, and there it said at the bottom, John 2:2. Jesus went to a wedding feast at Cana of Galilee, therefore it's okay for us to have sociables in the church. That isn't why he went. It tells you very plainly there, and in the last verse of that paragraph, in verse 11, it tells you why he went, and it tells you why he did what he did. Because you see, the Old Testament had said that when Messiah comes, he will bring gifts. Oh, not little grudging gifts, but great gifts of largesse. Not just a gallon or two of wine to make up for what his fellows may have drunk, but 54 gallons. You know. And from his fullness have we all received grace unto grace unto grace. But he's going to do it on his own terms. Bear that in mind. Why did he do it anyway? It tells you there plainly that his glory might be seen among his disciples. Glory. What's glory? Rise, shine, give God glory. Glory to God. All of those kinds of things. I'll tell you what glory is. It comes from an old word that means heavy. Weighty, substantial. Some days it might help if we didn't talk about giving God the glory, but understood that he is so weighty, so substantial, so heavy that you act like he matters. And the doxa, the glory, the light begins to shine. Even as in the ancient tabernacle, when it shone about to give evidence of the presence of God, now grace and truth shine from the face of Jesus Christ. And he begins to shine. The light that cannot be put out, but can be distorted and can be misunderstood, and it's going to be. That's coming up. So we've had a bridge toward faith in 2:1-11. Then there's the bridge of opposition. Always. Always. I'm ringing in my ears. Do be sensitive. I'm sorry, I do go up and down, but don't let me blare in your ears. You'll turn me out. A bridge of opposition, chapter 2, verses 13 through 22. The Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem, and they had an awful time. This was the first Passover of three that occur in John. You see, one of the motifs of John is that Jesus does his thing around the Jewish festivals. Jesus has his major acts around the Jewish festival times, and there's always trouble. And there was trouble when he went down to the Passover feast, because John places it at the beginning. Were there two cleansing of the temples? Kesabe. John is not intentionally trying to be chronological. He's trying to fit things into a theological motif. There could well have been two, one at the beginning. That's why they were so antsy all through his ministry. And one at the end. Or this might be the one that came at the end and is placed at this point, because John is saying, I want you to see the rising opposition of Jesus along with the fact that there is a kind of growing faith on the part of the apostles. The rising opposition was he went into the temple, and he didn't say you've got a borderline blood sugar problem. I do hope you'll watch your weight. He said, out, out. You know the rest of the Shakespearean quotation. He said, get out. And he reinforced it. He said, get out. And they did. There's an old hymn, gentle Jesus, meek and mild. See the faith of thy loving child. I single-handedly saw it didn't get in the present new hymnal. Of course, I'm still kind of mad because they didn't put my come drink at the spout where the gospel trickles out in. Nevertheless, he had muscles. I was pleased to hear one of you talk the other night about the fear of the Lord. Mercy, hadn't heard that for years. Building bridges with love, with friendship. You be sure that beneath that love there are tensile strengths of steel, that there are measures beyond which you will and will not go unless you prostitute the gospel and confuse it with psychological comfort of yourself, your friends, your way of life, your cultural context. There you've had it. Sorry about that. They opposed him. They said to him, what do you mean you'll tear this temple down? It and raise it again in 3 days. It took 46 years to put this thing together. Isn't it ironic that we pull out things to use when we want to? You see, they really hated the temple of Herod because they hated Herod, but it had taken 46 years. It made the temple of Solomon look like a shack. Sorry about that for those of you who've been influenced by romantic conceptions. But the great temple of Herod did take 46 years to build, and that helps us to date. This must have been the Passover of 28, 27 or 28 in the spring. And Jesus wasn't talking about that. He's never really talking about the things we're talking about. Won't you get with it today now in chapters 2, 3, and 4 and see that whatever level you're on, he's always on a deeper one. There's more, yes, much more. And when you sing that song, I wonder if you know how much more. There really is. He wasn't talking about that kind of temple. There's a bridge of opposition. If you're going to really be Christian, there's going to have to be. It disturbs me today, and I'm going to speak with your directors tomorrow about a lot of interesting things, including the electronic church. It disturbs me, young people, with all the good that's being done, that only half the gospel is being preached, because when the full gospel is being preached, there is an word of contradiction and not merely what people want to hear. Do you hear that? I told your older brothers and sisters in the 60s, When they were in the Jesus movement and raising their hands, and I love your spiritual lifestyles, they flow in and out, you know, but they were in this very auditorium raising their hands and dancing in the aisles and, you know, kind of full of froth and fury. I told them they were leaving one thing out, and that was the cross. And they said, but we want Jesus. He makes us feel so good. He gives us a natural high. Yeah, and he also lays it on you. And if he doesn't, he's not the full Jesus of the Gospel of John. The bridge of opposition. 2:13-22. And then the bridge of caution. Don't miss these two little verses, whatever you do. 23-25. You did read your homework this morning, didn't you? That is, before you came this morning. Chapters 2-4. Tomorrow's chapters 5 and 6. And incidentally, Bible study starts at 8:45. And some of you people who came tripping in late don't do that. And if you're standing in the aisles when the Bible's read, sit down where you are. Because the Bible's big stuff. All right? The bridge of caution. What's that? Now, he was in Jerusalem at the Passover feast. Many believed in his name when they saw the signs which he did. Great revival. But Jesus did not trust himself to them. For he knew what was in man. He did not need any man to tell him. He knows what is in man. What a chilling prospect. What an absolute teetotal chilling prospect. You see, I think you think. I really do, because I listened to your piety and I told you yesterday I loved you, and you've got to believe that. But what kind of love is it if it knows that being contrary to the gospel, there are certain kinds of things you're saying, you know, I'm doing God a favor. I'm praying to him. Or, well, I've confessed for the day. Now I will go and do what I please. Oh, folks, God has a little bit of caution about some of us. He can't always trust us. You say, oh, no, I've always got to have an accessible God who is my spiritual celestial bellboy. Well, then you get somebody other than the God of the gospel. He said, they believed on his name. There is an awesome, chilling thing that moves all through chapters 2, 3, and 4, which is the conclusion of the first part of John's gospel, that people are always believing on his name, but they're not really believing. It's only a mere step toward faith. They're believing because of the signs and the works that he does. You say, well, yeah, what's the use in believing in God if he's not going to help me pass geometry? We all get at that stage one time or another, don't we? I must confess to you, you would never think this of me. It's a confession. The other day I said to some poor miscreant, I said, one doesn't do that sort of thing. Oh, it's one of my favorite statements. I do it so well. One doesn't do that sort of thing. You know. And God said, yuck. And then I said, but God, there have got to be people around who uphold the standards. There have got to be people around who can discriminate for others between right and wrong at the drop of a hat. There have got to be people around who are the last of the Victorians that tell people what they should and should not do manners-wise in order that they will enjoy doing what they're doing. You know, if you tell them they can't do it, they enjoy it so much more. I said, now God, isn't all of that true? And God said, one doesn't do that sort of thing. What are some of your pretenses? Because you laughed, I know what you meant. You meant, hey, I've got some of those too. You say, I identify with that. Or more of you say, I thank God I'm not like that. You know, thank God I'm not as other people are. I heard that once before. And I'll let you in on a secret. Most of the other people are grateful too. okay? I wish you'd live today with that bridge of caution. God is not going to come to you on your terms. There's a slight bridge of caution. Just, you know, saying, I'm sorry, just weeping, just even, all of those things do not necessarily mean we really believe. There's always an element of risk in the Gospel of John. Because behind it all, there is one man whom John the Apostle cannot understand. And his name is Judas. And he's big stuff in the Gospel of John. We'll come to him tomorrow. And then, let's get off of this because it's too tender. Let's come to the third chapter and build a bridge of understanding. You say, oh, I've been looking forward to this because I love to have my prejudices massaged. I want to hear some great words about Jesus and Nicodemus. I'm not going to spend much time with this because that's where you've spent all your time. There's some marvelous things that go on here. A ruler of the Jews. Now let me get straight off, though I'll get on it more tomorrow. This gospel is not anti-Semitic. I'll define who the Jews are tomorrow. But a ruler of the Jews comes to Jesus by night. Now if Mark had said that, it would be giving you the time of day. But when John says that, it is not only giving you the time of day, it's talking about a kind of spiritual darkness that hangs over those who cannot understand. All the way through here, there is a lack of understanding. Have you ever prayed, you say, God, forgive me my sins, God, give me joy, God, give me this. Have you ever asked God to give you understanding? That your minds might be open? That's a Christian prayer too. And here's this marvelous bridge of understanding, and it does not come easy. It comes by prayer and fasting. We're not very good at that. You remember what an ancient geometer told a king, a prince, to whom he had been given the awesome, onerous task of being a tutor, and the little fellow stamped his foot and said, I'm a king. And the geometer said, Your Majesty, there is no royal road to geometry. Well, there's no easy way of understanding. There's no, you know, you don't have a shortcut. You don't have a card that gets you in. You and I walk the road of faith with all the others because, you see, He loves us as much as He loves all the others. You say, that's beautiful. No, you don't like that. You want Him to love you more than He loves all of the others. And He's not gonna do it. Okay? This is the gospel. So, he comes and he says, I want to inquire. And Nicodemus is a good man. We shall hear of him later. It is said that his and those descendants of Joseph of Arimathea later were starving in the streets of Jerusalem because they were ostracized by the community. But be that as it may, at this stage, Nicodemus is inquiring. And he says, tell me what I need. And Jesus said, those words that have become so commonplace in our day and time. You need to be born again. And by this time you resonate with it. You say, that's what we need, born again Christians. That's nice. What in the world do you mean? Dear hearts, I once had the assignment of going to a Jewish synagogue and tell them what it meant to be born again. You say, well, did you witness? I certainly did. And some went away sorrowing. Some Christians go away sorrowing when they understand what it means to be born again too. It means to have the shape of one's life redirected constantly. Constantly. You said, oh no, I did it some years ago. You started it some years ago, dear hearts. It's a process. Or you say, well, I want one of those kinds of religions where you walk down the aisle and you give your preacher the hand and get okay in 30 seconds with the spiritual chiropractic adjustment. Turn on the tube. But if you want to understand what it is to be born again from the gospel, then you will understand that it means that it's always blowing in the wind. And the wind comes from different directions. And when you think you've got it made, Jesus begins to see if there's a resilience about you that will let you move with His Spirit once more in other dimensions and directions. That which is born of Spirit is Spirit. Wind, breath, power, strength, glory. It has a starting point, and if you haven't had it, you ought to before you leave this place, if He enables you by His Spirit to do it. But if you have had it, you ought not to be leaning on your laurels, because being born again means you're being born into a new life, and that kind of life keeps going. Don't you understand the Gospel of John is a dynamic, ongoing, on with it, ever-loving kind of thing that restructures you? Being born again is not the high water mark, it's just the birthmark. That's it. And so we've got a right to talk about what's the relationship of ethics. And what does it mean on a day-by-day decision to be born again? You can't be unborn, but you can sure be stunted. This is the gospel. Bridge of understanding. Nicodemus finally went on out. And there's all of this Old Testament that keeps creeping in. The Son of Man being lifted up. For you see, Jesus knows the beginning from the end in the Gospel of John. No surprises here. Son of Man being lifted up like the serpent in the wilderness. Look and live. If you want to sing old gospel songs, get some of them that got good old biblical content. Look and live, my brother, live. Look to Jesus now and live. 'Tis recorded in His Word. Hallelujah. Look to Jesus now and live. And keep on looking. The point. Then we come to a bridge. Seems like it's almost a pattern of the rolling of the waves, of the dark and the light. After the great festival, then you have the bridge of contradiction. After this marvelous bridge of trying to build understanding to a man who's thinking in thoughts other than Jesus was thinking. And let me tell you something, we're always thinking in a channel less than Jesus is thinking. How many people do you know who say, if not, one doesn't do that sort of thing, who say, you do it your way and I'll do it His way. No, my dear young friends, the Gospel of John places an unmovable difference between Him and us always. You're not going to be absorbed into the light. You're supposed to walk in it. But Matthew says that we're the light of the world. Yeah, that's a reflected light. It's not the generator. If you want to understand the Gospel of John, read the letters of John. Best commentary I know. What's the best commentary on John 3:16? 1 John 4:9 and following. So now there comes another interlude, resurfacing the bridge. No, the intermediate bridge again, 3:22 through 30. One wonders why, and I've struggled for years for you. See, in this third chapter, the most marvelous of all the chapters, there are strange things going on. You've got Jesus and Nicodemus talking face to face, first and second person. And then you've got this strange interlude about John the Baptist. The intermediate bridge again. I think I'm beginning to see a pattern here. Maybe I'll write a commentary someday. I didn't get this one from Schnockenberg or any other Berg. I'm beginning to see the kind of pattern that says after the height, there comes a kind of low. Know anything about that? Well, here's the intermediate bridge again. They come up to John the Baptist and say, he's having a bigger Sunday school attendance than you are. Isn't that what it says? Well, more or less. And Jesus himself wasn't, as we shall see in the beginning of the next chapter, he wasn't baptizing anybody. Why not? Well, because, to put it candidly, his hour had not yet come. The Roman authority, the Jewish authorities were as mad as they could be at John the Baptizer, as we shall see, as you know from the sad story and the way in which that turned out. And so Jesus was not going to irritate them at places that were unimportant. Ah, Could we ever learn a lesson from that? You say, well, I sure did rub the salt in there. It wasn't a wound, it was a scab. If you're going to be an irritant, irritate at places that are important. And Jesus didn't baptize anybody, because right then his hour had not yet come, and he did not want to exacerbate the situation. How do you like that? Ooh, isn't that nice on Monday? He didn't want to exacerbate the situation any worse than it was. I think that's why he didn't baptize anybody. And John said, it's okay. John's a great guy. John announced the kingdom, but he didn't live long enough to fully get in it. And John said, it's okay. If he's got more than I've got, it's okay, because he's supposed to have them. Oh, wow. You know why some people are not going to be comfortable in heaven? Because there's just one person higher than they are. Better think about that. Certain religious figures, you know, Nietzsche said it in the last century. Nietzsche said, at least he was honest, there can't be a God. If there were, I could not stand not to be one of them. I know some religious people in the name of God who act like that. The intermediate bridge said, I'm glad. That's tough. Well, then let's resurface the bridge on 31 through 36. Now, this is the hard part, and I want to give you a tiny bit of help here. 31 through 36, resurfacing the bridge. Because if Jesus and Nicodemus are speaking in the early part of the chapter, and John the Baptist and the Jewish authorities and all the disciples and all are speaking in the next part of the chapter, who in the world speaking in the last part of the chapter? Probably John the Evangelist, the person who puts the stitches of the gospel together. And he says some marvelous things. He takes the end of this chapter to get his own sermon inspired of God in there, and it is a beautiful sermon. And I want to lift one thing out of it for you to resurface the bridge. He said, the Son of Man who has come down from heaven, he sees and hears what he has seen with God in heaven. He utters the word of God, and he gives the Spirit without measure. And what you think that means is, if I ask Jesus, he's going to give me such a big gift of the Holy Spirit that I and Jesus and the Spirit are always going to be right. Right? Wrong. That's not what that means. Why don't you let the gospel be about Jesus? It says that he is the one who gives and has been given the Spirit without measure. This means that the Father gave the Son full reign. When we used to work with royal ambassadors, we had a step called, and the young boys used to love it because when they finally learned to pronounce it, it sounded good. Didn't know what it meant, but it sounded good. We had an ambassador plenipotentiary. Full power. Now, Jesus is God's ambassador plenipotentiary. That's what this interlude means. He has been given the words of God, and he has been given the Spirit of God without measure. And if you're going to speak about God, you're going to have to speak through him and to him. That didn't set well, and in the arena of religions today, it does not set well. Well, we must move like Jehu through the street of Jerusalem. We've moved out from Jerusalem, up through Samaria. Chapter 4, verses 1 through 26 and verses 39 through 42, building a radical bridge of understanding. How long does it take to go from Jerusalem, for heaven's sake, to Galilee? Well, it took us 2 hours this summer in our air-conditioned tour buses. Normally in those days it took 3 days. And the shortest way was, and still is, however, because of political tensions, I thought it very interesting that we, like certain of the ancient Jews, would not go through Samaria. We went out around Perea and on the other side of the Jordan up, because we could not, for political tensions, go directly through Samaria this summer. The disciples, if they'd had their way, wouldn't have gone through Samaria at all. May I put it candidly for you, one doesn't go to that part of town. Got it? Who were the Samaritans? Every time the Jews mentioned their names, they did the ancient charming custom of spitting. And I might add, on the part of the Samaritans, to use a particularly chosen double entendre, the feeling was mucilage. Well, it's Monday, you're sleepy. They were people who stayed behind. They were the poor, the lame, the halt. They were the runts of the lot when Israel got carried off into captivity. And then they were the half-breeds that intermarried with the tribes that came in. And they thought they, on top of that, they thought they owned the world. They were so smart, they had their own mountain on Gerizim, where instead of Ebal, where they built an altar to God. And there is, to this blessed day, held together, my soul in sad exile, by Scotch tape, a Samaritan Pentateuch that's one of the oldest manuscripts in the world. There are 1,500 Samaritans left. Yeah, I mean, like today, now. About 1,500 Samaritans left, who declare and vow and swear they are the true people of God. And they really hated the Jews, and I repeat, the feeling was mutual. So, it's about as bad as you can be to be a Samaritan. And Jesus said, I'm going this way, fellows. And they grumbled all the way. The commentary I'm reading said, it is unknown why all of the disciples left him at Sychar's well. I know why they left him at Sychar's well. There was an estrangement among them. They were still pouting because he was going that way. And none of them wanted to be left alone with him to let him unload on them, because there are certain times when you should be uncomfortable in the presence of Jesus. Yeah. So they did. They all went to town. It didn't require that much. You know, they didn't have to all go. There wasn't that much bread. There wasn't that much meat they'd planned to buy. But they all left him. I think one human reason is they were somewhat estranged. They couldn't stand his piercing gaze, who would have said, don't you understand what I'm trying to do? And still you're pouting because we've come this way. And as though that were not bad enough, there's only one way down to Jacob's well, which is 107 feet deep, 7 feet wide, and still takes a bucket to get into it. And they had to face her going up while they were going down. You know what they did. I mean, not only was she a Samaritan, but she was a woman. And not only was she a woman, but she was that kind of woman. And you know how they walked by her. Let the gospel come alive. And Jesus talked to her. He said, I'd like a drink. Yes, you, woman. I'd like a drink. Well, that's a switch. You know. So, he said, I would give you to drink of the water of life. It's a mark of Jesus' cosmopolitanness that he could be comfortable with more than one kind of person. What about yours? And she said, hey, I'd like that kind of water. And then he said, bring your husband. She said, don't have one. He said, you're right. And then on the conversation went on, and he straightened her out theologically, you know. And then he said, however, come on back and drink from the water that comes from the well. Jesus gave her water that was not from the well. You learn those things going along. They're worth remembering. Occasionally something good happens to you. And she came back bringing others to the water who was not from the well. Evangelism? Sure, that's where it's at. Standing with Jesus long enough so that he can point out who you really are. And then swallowing the pride and saying, you're right. How'd you know? He knows what is in a man. That scary business. None of the pretense. None of the front. None of the sham. So, that's the bridge of radical acceptance. Can't tell you how radical it was. There's a bridge of inner resource in chapter 4, 31 through 38. They come back, the disciples, they see that he's talking to her. And she goes on back real happy. And then they say, well, here's your lunch. And he said, I've had something to eat. And Peter, whom you'll see tomorrow night, Peter said, well, why did you send us to that stupid Samaritan village for if you've got something to eat? Well, it isn't recorded in the gospel, but surely you've got enough elemental human psychology to know what Peter was thinking. It's a bridge of inner resource, and Jesus had it, and you'd better have some for tough times. And then when that was over and they finally got out of Samaria, and boy were the boys glad to get out of there, then they came back to Cana. And there came one of the hired lackeys of King Herod Antipas, that old fox. He was a pagan, a Gentile. I mean, Gentiles were almost as bad. Do you wonder now why the mission, lift up your eyes wide into harvest? 4 months, this must have been in December. Say not there are 4 months and the fields are white already. What in the world kind of crop is it that's got white? The white gowns that the Samaritans wore as they were trooping up the hill following the woman at the well. What kind of white did you think? That's the harvest. Say, I don't like their customs. I don't know their language. I don't like... Go out and get them and bring the harvest in. It comes in all colors. And then there's this marvelous bridge, the second bridge toward faith, 46 through 54. The man comes up and he says to Jesus, sir, please come and heal my boy. And Jesus said, that's trouble with you people. You're always wanting signs. Yee. That's what he said. But the man went on back, and his boy was healed. For the great physician had touched him. Sometimes that touch is abrasive. When I was in Cambridge, England, a couple of years ago, in Fen country, my knees got to hurting. Everybody should have arthritis in England. I went to a rheumatologist who sent me to a physical therapist. She was one of those no-nonsense British matrons who came in and said, we're having trouble with our knees, are we? I said, yes, I'm sorry to know you are too. Should never have said that, because she grabbed my knee and said, now tell me where it hurts. I said, oh lady, you've got your thumb on it. You've got your thumb on it. She kept it there for 10 seconds. I wished I hadn't said anything. I said, lady, that's it. Let go. And after 10 seconds, she did. She was using the new physical technique of acupressure. The great physician may come and touch you. And if it's really the great physician, it may hurt a while. If he touches you where you really, really live. He touched me. What a lovely thing. I don't know. Might hurt a little. Might hurt a little.